Hello everyone and welcome to another Scott Swihey podcast. And today I'm joined by writer Maud Wolfe. Hello Maud.
Hi, very happy to be here.
It's great to have you here, and we're going to be talking about your debut novel 13 Ways to Kill Lulabelle Rock, which is such a fantastic title. In fact, I'm sure before we get into the book more generally, where did the title come from and where did the name Lulabelle Rock come from?
Oh, well, it's not actually the original title that I wrote when I first finished the manuscript. Originally, it was going to be called The 13 Suicides of Lulabelle Rock. And I sent that out to loads and loads of agents, and a lot of them came back saying, this title is very grim. And so we did eventually decide to change it along the way, and there was a huge list of different titles sent to me. And after a while, my head blurred. But I liked 13 Ways because it reminds me of that old song. Is it 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover?
50 Ways to Leave Your Lover, yeah.
And as for the name Lulabelle, I don't know, it just sort of popped into my head one day. It was a little bit inspired by, I like old classic movies, and I'd recently watched Marilyn Monroe's, I think it's Gentlemen Prefer Blondes.
Yeah, it is. I was a big Monroe fan, yeah.
I think that's the one where there was a song called We're Just Two Girls from Little Rock, and I just like the idea of, I don't know, having a link to that sort of movie star part of it. And also it's just Jingle Bell Rock, I think in my head, which was an association I didn't actually realise until after I'd written the book and someone said, is this supposed to be Christmassy? And I thought, oh God, maybe.
In the way that some people have a go at Die Hard being Christmassy.
Yeah.
It made me think it's a little bit country, it's a little bit rock and roll, Lulabelle Rock, it's a great name. And that's interesting that the original one was the title you mentioned with suicide in the title. Did that change the writing of the book?
No, if anything, I think that maybe it just sort of lulls people into a false sense of security when they start reading. I didn't want people to start reading it thinking it was going to be very heavy. And there is a lot of heavy, dark stuff in the novel. But we went for a much sort of lighter approach with the cover and everything as well. So I like to think it's sort of, like I said, lulling people into a false sense of security and then getting them when they're in there.
Grabbing them. I think one of the great things about it is it does work on a number of levels, which we'll come into later on, you know, but it is really thrilling. But then, as you say, there's layers to it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you describe the novel to people when they say, what's 13 Ways to Kill Lulabelle Rock like?
As in the elevator pitch?
Yeah, how would that go?
Oh, God, I've done the elevator pitch so many times now that I'm worried I sound like a robot.
Okay.
Resort to the blurb, the glittering city of Bubble City in a near future world in which celebrities can commission portraits of themselves or clones to carry out all the different functions which they don't have time for in their busy lives. And one of them, a soon-to-be fading starlet, has commissioned 12 of them in her lifetime. But now, in order to gain fame and notoriety, she has commissioned a 13th one to track down and kill her predecessors. Well, did that sound robotic?
But it sounds a very good, concise way of telling people exactly what's going on. But now that it's out, do you look back and reflect differently on it?
Do I have a different conception of it now? Yeah, I suppose I do. I think when I started writing it, it felt more like a very personal, sort of quite introspective novel to me. And now when I see the marketing for it and see the way it's sort of come out into the world, it's more sort of like a fast-paced, action-y romp. And I remember thinking, oh, I didn't know I was writing that. But I'm glad that it's engaging. I think that was the most important thing when I was writing it.
That's really interesting to hear that, you know, the way that it's being publicised makes you feel kind of different about it, even though it's the same novel. But why did you want to write it in the first place?
Well, it was a pandemic novel,
right.
Partly. So I was working at a comic book shop in Bristol, because I was staying with my mum at the time, and we were just stuck in this flat all the time. Everyone from my work was put on furlough. So I was just sitting around the house, and I was sitting there and I was thinking about all this, because it had been my first job after leaving university. And I remember even when I was working thinking, how does anybody have time in their lives to go and have a job, earn money, and then come back and have a social life and be able to create things if you're an artist? And just wishing that I could sort of segment myself into different parts so I could sort of go out and do these different things and just focus on one thing at a time. And then I was sitting around having nothing to do during the pandemic, worrying a lot, as everyone was. And it just sort of popped into my head one day. And I started writing the next day.
Did you study writing?
Not before that, actually. I went to university in Aberdeen and I studied English and art history.
Mm-hmm.
And then after writing Lulabelle, my mum actually encouraged me to go for a creative writing course. And then I moved to Glasgow to do that. And then over the course of that course, I sort of worked on the book more and fine-tuned it and finally got in touch with an agent again.
So the book was written in a form, in a draft, and then you were able to, through the writing course, get feedback and,
yes.
and all of those things.
Definitely. It was very different from when I first wrote it. I think the first draft was very short. It was, I don't even know if it could be called a novella, really. And then I just kept tinkering with it. And originally I thought that was sort of, people talk about their first drafts as everyone has a terrible book in them. And then you get that out of the way and you can start writing good things. So I thought that was my terrible book. And then I could sort of move on to other things. But then the more I worked on it, the more I sort of fell in love with it again. And yeah.
So. Well, that central idea must have been strong enough that you think, well, you know, I'm going to keep that hold.
Exactly, yeah.
But people often say that debut novels are, you know, the writer's own life stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading this thinking, well, this can't be Maud's own life story. This is far too. But there will be things that you kind of care deeply about in the book. You can tell that as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think that the idea of it, I mean, I don't like the term coming of age that much, but I do think in a way it is a reflection of sort of being thrust out into the world and then having to choose between these different roles that are put aside for you and feeling like you have to make a positive choice to continue living for something and to do something with your life. So I guess it was personal to me in that sense. And also choosing which parts of yourself to kill and which parts to love, I guess.
And I hadn't thought about how personal that might be. And had you written other things before that? Or was this literally your kind of first attempt at a novel and it's become the published edition?
Oh, I think I wrote, when I was 18, I wrote this like truly atrocious fantasy novel, which was, I think, pretty much solidly ripped off Star Wars.
You wouldn't be the first to do that.
No. And I remember, and I wrote this when I was 18 to 19 and I was incredibly proud of it. And then I reread it just the other day and I was thinking, oh God, what was I thinking? But maybe that'll be another novel at some point. I'll just have to pay my respects to Lucas with that one.
And again, I don't think you're not the first writer I've spoken to who said, oh, I can't read my debut novel or an early novel because I would just want to go through it with mm-hmm. a blue pen and
exactly.
kind of do it all over again. Well, that's interesting. You mentioned fantasy, and I consider this sci-fi. I don't know if you do. Do you consider yourself a sci-fi fantasy writer, or is that too limiting? Is that the kind of thing reviewers do?
Well, originally I thought myself as a horror writer. I wrote a lot of horror short stories, some of which got published in different magazines and things. And I always thought if I had a first book, it would be a horror novel. But now I guess I would use the term speculative writer.
That covers a lot, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's the good thing about that term. It's kind of a get out of jail free card. But I think that blending fantasy and sci-fi and horror in my work, I don't think I could ever just do one. I think it has to be sort of a combination of all of them going forward. But I do like sci-fi. I feel like sci-fi is just sometimes you could just use it to tell fairy stories, which is what I really wanted to do with Lulabelle in a way.
Yeah, I guess it does kind of work like a fairy tale, almost Alice in Wonderland, discovering different characters as you move through things
exactly.
and learning lessons along the way. And it's interesting you mentioned horror. Now, it might just be the things I've read recently, but it seems to me that horror is making a comeback in fiction. There's quite a few people who are touching on kind of a horror tropes.
Well, there's so many fantastic horror writers out there. And I do think that it's not sort of like B horror movie things anymore. I recently reread Under the Skin by Michael Faber.
I have the poster of the film version on the wall. That's what I'm pointing at.
I didn't even notice that.
I love it as a book. It's amazing.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
And I love that it's so based in Scotland as well. I was going for a walk in the Highlands the other day and I got this prickling sensation on the back of my neck just thinking about scenes from it. And I think that, I mean, I do think that like there's a certain gothic element to Scotland in general, which is really fun to tap into. Yeah.
But I talked to you for a long time about Under the Skin, but you're absolutely right. There's something which is absolutely sci-fi in a sense, but set just off the A9. And, you know, it's so kind of local that you could almost take yourself to the farm that's there. It's amazing to kind of be able to do that.
And it's more scary by the fact it feels so close, just outside your back door.
Yeah.
I think that... I do think that with horror, there's just so many emerging talents at the moment. And I was really inspired by Carmen Maria Machado. She's this American author who wrote a novel or collection of short stories called Her Body and Other Parties.
Right.
And I was reading that right before I wrote Lulabelle. And people use the words Black Mirror-esque a lot now to describe it. But really, I think if I was following anyone's tradition, it would be hers. It's just, just like one thing off about our world.
Yeah.
And that kind of sense of eeriness.
Uncanny.
Yes.
Often, yes, absolutely. So, as I said before, the novel works on a number of levels. It is a real thriller, but there is a lot more going on. And what themes were you interested in examining through it?
I suppose identity, to a certain extent, about who we are. Can we be compartmentalised without damage, like lasting damage to the psyche? Can we actually split ourselves off into different people, which everybody does in their daily lives, which is to sort of have different versions of yourself, to do different things, a family version, a friend version, and whether or not we should be seeking a way to sort of combine those and go forward and embrace those, that kind of multifaceted part of our identity, or whether it's okay to sort of have those be different and think of them as different parts. So yeah, identity, and also I suppose capitalism as well. I was really very struck by a lot of recent news about artificial identities.
Yeah.
And the way that they were using dead actors' images. And I don't know, there was Audrey Hepburn was in a chocolate advert where they basically just used the scan of Audrey Hepburn and they put her in these chocolate adverts. And I remember watching that and feeling so creeped out that she had no idea that she would ever be used in that way.
Yeah.
And now actors are having to like write into their contracts that they to try and control that image, so they're not used posthumously. I mean, actor Carrie Fisher died and then they continued to put her in Star Wars. Yeah. And yeah, I don't know, it seemed to me like a frightening sort of revenant type existence for celebrity figures to literally become products in that way.
Yeah, I mean, I do remember there was talk at one point about, you mentioned Marilyn Monroe, but a future Marilyn Monroe film or a James Dean film or these real iconic characters that they would make future things with.
Yeah.
And there's also been musicians on stage that they've brought back to life in that way to kind of perform. And it is something really quite... When I first read 13 Ways to Kill Lulabelle Rock, it was just when there was a lot of AI stuff in the news. You know, everyone was really fretting about what this could do for the future. And I thought, crikey, what a timely novel that this is. You know, that and probably won't put anyone at ease that's worried about it.
It's one of those things where people look back on it and think, oh, well, we were worried about nothing. That was fine.
Yeah.
But I don't want it to come true.
No.
But I do think that we are getting to the point where we are fully viewing people as industries rather than individual human beings. And people always say, you know, people are a product and everything, but I do think there's like a very literal version of that happening with entertainment specifically.
Yeah, that's true. And this idea that we're all playing different roles, and often we play different roles to ourselves, that comes through with Lulabelle Rock. You know, there's different versions clearly of Lulabelle Rock, but even 13 kind of discusses with herself, well, who am I supposed to be? What does it mean for me to exist? You know, if I do no longer exist, what does that mean for my memory? As you say, it can happen with celebrities in particular. There's a lot of philosophical ideas going through this, I think. I mean, I was thinking back to how do you know that, you know, you're in a reality and all those kind of brain in a jar and all those kind of things.
Nature
that are
versus
going on.
Nurture, that sort of stuff.
Yeah. Well, one of the other things I wanted to talk about was the chapters are named after tarot cards with explanations of each. Can you talk a bit about how that fits into the book and, you know, why that is in there?
Well, at the time, I've used tarot cards ever since I was little. I'm not really a believer that they have any magical properties to them. I just think they're sort of a fun sort of Rorschach test. Sometimes in your life you can sort of work out your own thoughts by using them. And at the time that I was writing, I was feeling very lost and sort of, I wasn't sure what I wanted to do. I wasn't sure where I wanted to go or live. So I would be looking at these cards to sort of try and give myself a structure. And I liked the idea of a character who can't really distinguish between a sort of structure that is given to her by other people. And she's looking for meaning, as a lot of us do, in more spiritual places. But she's somebody who will take, for instance, she would read a manual about her own body and existence and take it in the same way as the tarot cards, because they're just a guide to how to be, really. And also, it really helped me as a writer to be able to structure it in that way.
I guess chapter by chapter you can...
The original draft didn't have those little intros mm-hmm. with describing the card. And one of my first readers said, I really like this, but I don't know anything about tarot.
Yeah.
So I would just love to have, even if you could have like an illustration. So for a while I was toying around with the idea of having a little illustrated card for each chapter, which I still think would be fun to do, maybe for a later edition, crossing my fingers. But I think that I just loved the idea of being able to set up the readers for something so they would search for it within each chapter as well.
I think the little descriptions really helped, because I only knew the kind of outward ideas of tarot and, you know, some of the big cards and how they've been used in film and TV and in other books. So I think that was really helpful. But it was also quite surprising, because I think you've got this kind of modern, as you say, near future, but it's quite technologically advanced, that is, mm-hmm. it seems to me. And you've got these ideas of cloning an AI, and then you've got tarot, which seems almost from a different age, from an earlier age, from perhaps a more spiritual age as well.
Yeah, well, I really like the way in which people have used the internet to sort of seamlessly wound it into their own sort of spirituality. I wrote an earlier short story about somebody who found a love spell online. Because there are huge amounts of, like, witches who are practicing online and holding Zoom calls to sort of, doing tarot readings online, even doing sort of medium services, sort of getting in contact with the dead, over Twitter or something, and casting spells on each other and things. And it just tickles me, I guess, to think how much, despite the means and tools that we have change, the way that people are still the same.
People's kind of thoughts and ideas and kind of wishes and even beliefs are still the same, but the technology has changed along that.
Yeah, and people use magical thinking with their devices constantly. I remember talking to a friend of mine once, and she said that when she was in a time of crisis, she would put her Spotify on shuffle, and she felt like the universe was talking to her through whatever song came up. And I remember being so charmed by that, and this idea that sci-fi and modern technology and all these sort of more futuristic devices are actually being used in that way to sort of give you messages from beyond.
I guess that's absolutely true. This idea that choice or chance or fate or whatever it might be is still with us, and we still wish for that and doing it in through something like a shuffle service is brilliant.
Instead of like looking for answers in the trees, you're looking for it from your laptop screensaver or something.
And we've spoken about Lulabelle Rock, but there are other characters in the book, and I'm interested in how you start to put this world together. Did you have the kind of central idea of Lulabelle and the versions of her and then start to put it together, or does the plot kind of provide you with characters, so to speak?
I knew who each of the different portraits that she'd meet along the way were. I didn't know exactly how she'd meet them or how she'd encounter them, so I really just started out, I used the cards for inspiration actually. Mm-hmm. And so I think her being on a journey, like a very physical journey, really helped with that, because like you said, I like the idea of somebody encountering figures along the way who guide them, like an Alice in Wonderland, or confuse them and set them back. So I think it was again, a very easy way to structure 13 portraits, originally 13 chapters in the book as well. There was definitely some figures who weren't portraits who I knew were going to be central at the beginning. But other characters like the hitchhiker that she encounters early on, I suppose I just wanted her to have somebody who was equally confused at the beginning of the novel. I don't know, and I've always liked hitchhiking as well, so I like the idea of just picking someone up along the way and then it being completely changed in the trajectory of your life just by a conversation.
That one encounter absolutely changes things. I feel, in many ways, it's a classically told tale. What I mean by that is you've got the kind of almost the Greek way of, you know, a hero setting out on a journey, encounters different people along the way, has the successes, has the knockbacks, and then, you know, there's a kind of conclusion at the end of it. Was that something you were aware of as you were writing it?
Well, I think that actually came from the tarot again. Because the major arcana, sorry, it's a bit technical, but the major arcana is sort of framed like a journey. You start with the fool who sets out on a wandering into the abyss, about to step off for a cliff and not even knowing it. And you go through different figures who offer advice, and then you have disasters like the tower or the specter of death and things. And then the final one of the world is this idea that you see everything as it is and sort of come to the end. So I do think that was helped in that way. But I think that what I wanted to do is, because it was all moving in circles around and around the city, I felt like it was really important for the main character to have a very clear sort of rise and change over the course of the novel. So the structure had to come from her changing rather than from outside influences.
Right.
Like, she doesn't save the world at the end.
No.
The portraits aren't abolished. She doesn't change the structure of society, but she changes.
But I thought between all the kind of encounters and the hits, it's her ruminations on people and places and herself, that's where the real kind of emotion lies in it.
Exactly. I think that at some point I worried it was episodic. It was just sort of find another one, kill, find another one, kill. And it is in that way. But I think that, like I said, it really has to be about her as a person. I think that in any novel, I think that's what I care more about, is the character's progress as you go along. I feel like a novel needs to be about how the world changes you, not about how you change the world.
Yeah, I mean, that's what I loved. I didn't know anything about it before I read it. And that's what really grabbed me, was the changes that that number 13 particularly kind of feels as it goes along, you know, because they're recognisable. You might come to, you know, a sci-fi book and say, well, this is about, you know, clones and an assassin, if you like, and all of those things. But actually, there's so much more going on in that. And it made me think about influences as well. Other authors that, you know, in particular, that influenced Lula Bell Rock in particular?
It's funny. I feel like I was more influenced by films than by books when I was writing it.
That's what I thought when I was reading it. I was kind of going, oh, that's a bit like that, and that's a bit like that.
So. Yeah, I noticed in your review, you actually mentioned Sunset Boulevard, which is a fantastic film and one of my favourites. So I was really pleased to read that, which is this idea of this, like, ageing starlet, like, locked away in her house, sort of, striving to recapture that sort of shine. And I just love that. I love this idea of like these old sort of, like, a fairy tale figure, like of a sort of like a crone or something, or a wizard. And I think that does play into the fantasy part as well. But Blade Runner, obviously, huge inspiration. A little bit of The Island was in there as well. The one with Ewan McGregor. And also kind of cartoons in general. It felt very much like I saw it in my head as an animation.
I could see that now you're mentioning it. Yeah, absolutely.
I watched a lot of Miyazaki films. And I think that something we were talking about, the way it's more about how the main character is changed by things. And he often has, like, young children as his protagonists who are sort of changed by the world around them. And the novel or the movies end with them sort of realizing a new perspective and being old enough to sort of handle it as themselves.
Yeah.
And I think that was a big part of it for me as well.
It would make a great anime, now that you're mentioning it. Yeah, because you could go full splatter and all of those things. And, oh, yeah, I like the idea of that. And actually, a film which has not only just occurred to me now because of what you mentioned earlier on about, you know, dividing yourselves into different parts, you know, that kind of idea of, oh, I've got so much to do if I had different people doing it. Have you ever seen Multiplicity?
No, I haven't.
So it is, the name will come to me. who played Batman? Michael Keaton. Michael Keaton's in it, and I think Andy McDowell. And that's kind of what that's about. If I remember, it's a long time since I've watched it, and it wasn't a big hit, but he kind of, there ends up with loads of Michael Keatons basically doing different parts, and there's scenes where one of them's doing the hoovering and one of them's doing the washing up, and he's kind of split himself into these, it's not a great film, but it's just interesting.
No, but like, I would need to check that out. I think there's another director who, I'm blanking on the name, but he did Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Oh yeah, Michael Gondry, is that right?
Is that, yeah.
I think that's right.
Perhaps. But like, there's sort of like films which are just weird, I think. I think that that kind of, I think if I want anybody to describe my writing to anything, it's like kind of weird. I like living in that space. And it's so fun to do with text and imagine visuals in the same way you would write a movie, I think.
And Lulabelle herself, I mean, you mentioned Marilyn Monroe and we mentioned Sunset Boulevard. Was there one inspiration for even the kind of look and, you know, how carried herself, or was that a kind of amalgamation of just your own thoughts?
Yeah, I suppose she's sort of an amalgamation of all those. I imagine her more as a classic Hollywood starlet, not so much a modern one. I don't know, I imagine her looking a bit like Veronica Lake, maybe, or just having that kind of magnetism. But no, I don't think I'd already had anyone in mind. And in a way, I wanted to avoid having one person in mind, because I didn't want it to be... Well, firstly, I think it'd be a bit of a character assassination.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
Yeah,
you can't say, oh, it's terrible what they're doing to these people, and then you'd go and say...
Yeah, exactly, and then go ahead and use them. But yeah.
But in a sense, that kind of feeds into the book as well, because I got the sense that this is someone almost from an earlier age... Mm-hmm. Almost old Hollywood, that's the feel I got. And here's this kind of modern world with all the demands that you can't just be one thing, particularly Lulabelle Rock, but perhaps women in general are being asked to be many things to many different people, and including themselves. And this perhaps is the way that she saw to even attempt that.
Yes, and being constantly accessible. I think when I think about the difference between old Hollywood and new Hollywood, it's this idea that you would have stars and you wouldn't really have that much access to them.
Yeah.
They would appear in the movies, they would appear at premieres and things. But now we know so much about celebrities and so much about each other in general. And I do think there is, specifically for women, there's this need to be desirable but mostly consumable, like a product, sort of, and to have people to have access to you constantly. And I think, I mean, even waking up in the world today, like going about your life, and you have all these emails you need to answer, you know, you feel this pressure. I think as a, like a debut author, a big part of it is sort of having a certain amount of pressure to use your social media correctly and to sort of make yourself a personality and
accessible, as you say, where you might not be, you know, in general, people might not be comfortable in that. Because I find that not just with authors, but musicians often, you know, really fantastic musicians who are great at what they do, and they hate the idea of having to be something, some person online.
Yeah, and a lot of them hire social media managers to sort of do that for them, obviously. Mm. But I do think we're seeing live streams on the inside of celebrities' houses, you know, where people, I mean, I was looking, going to a rabbit hole of this the other day, but like people want to consume celebrities often in the most literal way. I mean, you hear about people's hair being sold at auction, and I don't know, I think there was a jar of Angelina Jolie's and Brad Pitt's breath that was sold at a celebrity auction for a huge amount. And obviously, I don't know, you hear about old starlets, their clothes being auctioned off and all of that stuff as well.
Yeah, I think as well, there was somebody had a lock of John Lennon's hair or something like that.
I think it was one of his teeth.
Oh, that one. So you'd start to think, this is Jurassic Park. We're going to clone a Beatles fantasy park or something. Yeah. Like
that. That's another novel idea.
There's another
one.
But there are other aspects of the book that you feel readers and reviewers haven't picked up on. You know, things that you think, oh, nobody's mentioned that, or, you know, this theme or anything like that.
Honestly, kind of the opposite. I think what's very strange about having your book go out into the world and be read is that people are picking up on things that you had no idea that you were really writing about at the time. One of my really good friends read it, and she said, you know, as somebody who is autistic, and because she's autistic, she said, I really saw so much of myself in this character that she is, like, she's trying to pick up, she depends on certain objects to sort of keep her grounded. She feels like she's trying to take everything at face value and then getting caught out. And I remember thinking, oh, I didn't actually intend that when I was writing it, but I love that it can be that. And if it's there, it's there.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's what, you know, when you put a book out there and you start to get interaction with the readers, that's the thing. They bring their own backgrounds and feelings and all those things to it.
I think the best way to do that, handle that, is really by sort of letting go of it.
Yeah.
And just deciding that the minute it's out in the world, it's sort of out of your hands. And I really love seeing that. I like the idea that I don't think... There's some line or something about how every story is different because it's read by someone who's bringing their own experiences and own sort of background to it. Obviously, it's not so great when they read something maybe malicious into your story that you didn't intend. But I haven't had that so far. But
and you can't help that as well. You know, that's that. And then you can just say, well, that says more about you than it does about me.
Yeah, I think that bad faith readings are understandable. But again, that's your understanding of it, then I can't really argue with that.
And so this is your debut. Are you already a bit thinking about what you're going to be working on next, or can you talk about that? You don't have to.
I am thinking about what I want to do next. I wish I was doing more of what I was going to do next rather than just thinking about it. I think it's I've struggled a lot with writing a second novel, just because I think all the having people talk so much about your first, it's not only distracting, but there's a huge sense of pressure of trying to like recapture that for the next one and worrying about whether or not you'll be able to do it again. But I am writing something at the moment, and it's more Glasgow-based, which I'm really excited about, because if I had one regret about my first novel is that it's quite American in a lot of ways. And I'd really love to write something about Scotland and based on my experience of Scotland as well. So I can't say too much.
No, that's fine. I think there are a couple of things that are interesting. I think this almost had to be American, I would think.
Yeah.
You know, for it all to make sense, because that's exactly the world that's in.
I mean, maybe London a bit, but not to the same extent. I wanted to be very Silicon Valley inspired more than
it's
anything.
It's LA. It really is LA. And I think it's something that a lot of people find, particularly when you're doing something like this, when you're publicising your novel and half of your mind's on what's going to happen next, you know, because you're starting to live in a different world.
Exactly, yeah. And I think sometimes when people say they like certain things about your first novel, you start to overthink it and you're thinking, oh God, am I putting enough of that in the next one? I think my next novel will be fairly different in tone. So I think I think that the strategy I've been trying to use is just pretend that this is the only book I've ever written. It's the book I'm writing now. But we'll see how that goes.
Yeah, that's probably quite a good one, yeah. But probably quite difficult to do as well. And can you talk about your road to getting published and the kind of stages you went through? Because I think people would be interested in that.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had a very sort of strange road to it. When I first wrote the book, back in lockdown, the minute I finished it, I sent it off to my first readers, and the minute they gave me their feedback, I sent off the novel to a huge amount of literary agents. I think maybe 30 literary agents received drafts of this. A few of them never wrote back. Some of them wrote back and said, sorry, we can't accept it at the moment. One person asked to get the full manuscript, which was very exciting. But then on reading, she decided not to go for it. And so I just kind of tucked the novel away at that point.
Right.
And then when I did my creative writing course, there was a competition for a first draft of a debut novelist.
Right.
And I didn't actually win that, but I came as a runner-up. And the first prize was getting in contact, or they would, you'd be signed by a literary agent who would agree to represent your novel.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't actually win it, but one of my teachers, Zoe Strachan, who we were talking about earlier, is a great writer as well. She told me that one of the people who had been judging the novelist was named Lena Langley, and she had really, really pushed for my novel to win. And she said that I should actually get in contact with her and send the novel to her directly and ask if she wants to read it. And so I did. And then Lena ended up becoming my literary agent.
So
that got me signed. And from there on, I just sort of got into the process of having it be edited and edited, going through a lot of different drafts, and then finally being sent out in spec.
So the editing process, or you did an editing process before it even went to publishers?
Oh, yeah. I think the book must have been rewritten. I don't even know what draft the final one is.
That's interesting.
That might not always be the case. I've talked to other writers who said that they felt like it was sent out right away with the changes. I was very grateful to have other people look at it and give me such in-depth feedback and sort of get it to a point where I was happy with it being sent out. I feel like in a lot of ways the book is collaborative in some ways, because I got so many ideas from the people who I gave it to read and so much feedback. It's a long process. Yeah. I think it was edited a lot just when I talked to Lena the first time, and then when we got signed to Angry Robot, there was even more edits then at that point before finally going out. But I'm very happy with the shape it's in at the moment.
Well, that's really interesting. I worked for a while for a small publisher as an editor. So I only ever saw or worked with writers once we decided we were going to take the book on. Mm-hmm. And it'd be interesting to know how many other people do that amount of work before it even gets sent out. And I would imagine, I don't know, you'd be more likely for it to be picked up if you've done that kind of work
definitely.
On it already.
I think that's partly why I'm so grateful to Lena for working with me so intensely, because to have somebody take that much of a chance on your book, to put that much work in, because until I got signed, she wouldn't see a penny as well. Yeah. So she was she was really investing in me, and having someone who believes you in you that much to put that effort in, to rewrite a whole book multiple times. It's fantastic. So I'm very grateful. But I do think that with work, with books, I do think that I could keep on changing them.
Yeah,
forever.
Yeah, you've eventually got to let it go, haven't
you? Yeah, exactly. At a certain point, you have to be like, right, I am just going to send this out.
And usually that's a publisher's deadline at that side of things. Yeah, this book has to be done by
exactly,
then.
Exactly, yeah.
And your manuscript's with your publisher, and what's the relationship, you know, been like? Once it's there, you've got another editor to work with?
Yes, I have a different editor, Simon at Angry Robot, and he was great too. So you're working with lots of different people, and you're working with, and then after the editing process is done, you have a lot of sort of the publicity side of it as well, and marketing as well. What's funny to me is seeing the point where your sort of raw novel, they decide what genre it is and what the selling points are and what sort of pitches they're going to do to people. Because I think that's a very... It's strange, sort of not being pigeonholed, but suddenly being told what your market is and everything.
See, this is interesting to me, because often as a reviewer or writing about other, you've got to kind of say, well, where does this sit? Where's this going to sit in a bookshop, or what, that kind of thing? And it's kind of not, from a writer's point of view, I'm guessing, you never think like that.
No.
You're just writing a book that you really like and you hope people will read.
Yeah, I didn't even, I mean, it gets marketed with dystopia a lot. And I remember writing and thinking, oh, I didn't think it was that dystopian. I mean, it is, but it doesn't feel that different from our world to the point where it would be dystopian.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I like seeing that side of it. It can be a little, I mean, I've spoken to other authors who feel like the book that they wrote is not the book that was sent out into the world, in the sense that it's being pushed in a different way than they would want it to be, and so on. Luckily, that wasn't my experience with it. But it's a transformative process, and it requires being pretty objective and being able to take a long step back from your own work, which isn't always that easy.
That must be really disappointing for a writer, if, you know, to go through all this and say, I'm getting published, and then not to be happy with, you know, what goes on. And I don't know this for sure, but I would think maybe working with an independent publisher or a smaller publisher, you're more likely to be more collaborative. Was that what you found?
Exactly. And to be honest, there was a point where, I won't say exactly who, but I had the choice that there were two different publishers interested in taking the novel. And a little bit was a bidding war. Not a massive bidding war, I wish. But most of it was really me wanting to go with the people who I thought would sort of have more time for me, I suppose, which is something really nice about an indie publisher as well.
And people who get it.
Yeah, people who get it. People who genuinely love the book enough to be enthusiastic about it. And that's really been the best part about working with Angry Robot, is that everyone I've talked to seems to really like the book, and I don't think they're buttering me up. But I think there's an effort made to sort of... I think they really, really stand behind their authors, which is nice.
When I first read it, I thought, yeah, this is an Angry Robot book. So I read a few of their books over the years, and they're really good at, you know, they obviously have a clear idea of what and who they want to publish, and they get it right pretty much every time, in my experience of them. Did you have much input into things like covers and, you know, blurb and all that kind of stuff?
I got consulted along the way. I would be shown different covers, or me and Lena would be shown different covers, and we'd be sort of asked which ones, what we thought of them and stuff. But the final choice was ultimately in their hands along the way. But again, I think I feel fairly like I'm feeling very zen about it. That I feel like you do just have to come to terms with the fact that you can't be in control of things once it's left your hands.
Yeah.
As long as people like the words inside the book, that's the most important
thing. That's the most important thing. Yeah, absolutely. And do you have advice for anyone who's just starting out, who's at the beginning of their career? Anything that you've found in your experience so far that you would think, yeah, this is a good thing? For instance, you went to the creative writing course. Mm-hmm. Did you get advice there, not just on the writing, but on things like how to get an agent and different aspects of the whole process?
We did, actually. We had an editing and publication sort of focus in the course, which was really good, which was really sort of getting you in touch and knowing the process, so that when I came to the process myself, I didn't feel like I was jumping in blind, which was really important. But I suppose my main advice would be just don't let rejection sort of put you off. Everyone says this, but I really did put my book out to so many places, and and before that, I was putting short stories out to so many places, and I have a special rejections folder of my email where I just have all the different short story rejections and things that I had. And just to keep on going and decide that also just not everything is everybody's cup of tea, but it's not necessarily a reflection on you. But then if people give you feedback, take that on board, because it's rare that people have the time to give you feedback if they're rejecting you. So if they're giving you feedback, like, listen to it.
Yeah, because they've read it and they care enough to actually give you feedback. And Lulabelle Rock is a memorable character, there's no doubt about it. Has she stayed with you after the book's been published? Because I spoke to some writers who think, oh, I've still got that, you know, my protagonist is with me, and I still think about them quite a lot. Has that been the case, or have you managed to kind of go, right, that's been done?
No, I mean, she's definitely still with me, I think, and that sometimes I worry that I end up writing people who sound like her. But I think she's just, I don't know, I'm so fond of her, and all the different incarnations that I kind of like it in a way, because it kind of bolsters me to keep going with other things. But no, I don't feel haunted, if that's what you're asking.
I know, I guess, well, maybe haunted is the right word. I think perhaps it is the right word, because I know I've spoken to people who they're writing their next book, and this character, in fact, funny enough, a character from, a kind of side character from one book has now had two novels written about them as the central character by a writer I know. So that's a quite interesting in itself, that maybe there are some, are there other characters in Lulabelle Rock that you think about?
Again, really, well, this it kind of comes back to what I feel. This might sound a bit pretentious, but I sometimes think of writing as kind of like an exorcism, is that when you're in the writing process, you just think about that all the time, and you're thinking about those characters, and you're thinking about the world. And then writing the novel, for me, is a way of sort of getting that stuff out of my head so that my head is clear for something new. So I think that I have successfully banished them now. But, I mean, now they can sort of be people who I can meet and visit again as friends. Though I'm still not at the point where I can reread the novel and be completely objective about it.
Well, I guess that's probably right. It's been, especially when it's been through so much work to get to this
stage. I've still got that red fine liner in my head, like you said.
And how have you found this side of things, the publicity side of things, like, you know, on podcasts and doing book launches and, you know, all that side of things?
It's nerve-wracking, definitely, but I find that once I start doing it, it's all right. It's the moments before that I start to get my stomach is trembling. But I think that it's been much better once I sort of relaxed into trying not to sound like how an author should sound and just sort of being myself a bit more. I think that the funniest part of it is really taking you so seriously.
Yeah.
going from sort of being a student to suddenly people asking for advice on writing, which someone did at my book launch. And I remember sitting there and thinking like, oh, you're asking me for advice? I ask other people for advice. But it was, it's good. I think it's, I'm getting more used to it as I go along.
Because I'm guessing that the whole process of the debut novel must be a bit of a whirlwind like that. Because you go, I was going to say you go from hope to expectation, but and everything in between. But you kind of do from, well, I hope this gets picked up, and then you're working on it, and then it has been picked up, and then it must be quite a whirlwind.
It is, definitely. And I think that, because of my course, there were so many people who wanted to get published. And I think when you're in that before getting published side, it's almost like trying to think beyond the happy ever after thing.
Yeah.
It's like you're so focused on this one thing that you want incredibly badly that when it actually happens, I think it's a little bit of a shock to your system. And you almost don't know how to react to anything. I keep expecting to sort of wake up from a dream sort of thing.
But I think once you've been published, people have your book in their hands, then you do become someone that people will ask questions about, like, how did this happen? I want this to happen. How did it happen for you?
I think talking to other authors has probably been the biggest thing to help me through it. The person who chaired me, Joma West, very talented author, also based in Glasgow, and she writes science fiction as well. I had a chat with her before the chair, and we ended up having like an hour-long conversation just about all the different stages of the publishing process.
Yeah.
And just talking to someone else who's been through it was the biggest relief, and very nice, because I was thinking when I was talking to her, oh God, I'm talking to an author, you know?
Yeah.
And then, well, she was talking to an author
too. That's right, that's right. But I can guess, I can imagine that takes a while to kind of sink in.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, I've still got a day job, you know, and I've still got... And my friends are very good at keeping me grounded. Maybe it's too good. And my family and things. I don't know. So I feel like it's almost like a sort of secret identity sometimes.
A role. It's your...
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Maud, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to me. I really love the novel, I have to say.
Oh, I wish
you all the best with it.
Well, thank you so much for having me on. It's been lovely.
And we'll be back soon with someone completely different.